Calum's Lion, so glad that you're here. My name is Chris, one of the pastors. We're in week 4 of the series, A Good and Beautiful Life. I want to remind you where we're getting this from. It's in a book called Galatians. Galatians was written about 50 AD. That's about 15, 20 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus. In this ancient letter to this ancient church, Paul says this, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And he ends this sentence by saying, against such things, there is no law. And what he's meaning is this, is that all of these things everybody knows are common good. Like, these are the good things of life. There is no a case against them. That's what he's saying. There is no law. There is no charge against these things. Why? Because we all know that they're good. We all know that we want them. The question is, what is their origin and what is their source? And so this is such a great series. If you are new to Christianity, a friend has sent you this and you're just kind of peering in. This is so good because we all want those things. And the Christian faith says you actually get them through Jesus. If you're a believer in Jesus, been following him a long time, your need of those virtues are very, very, very high. And this is a great series for you. This weekend, we're looking at the idea of patience. And this kind of working definition that's going to flow throughout our time is that patience is remaining calm while you wait for something. Remaining calm while you wait for something. Man, we all know that we need that. We want that more in our life. And here we are, though, living in a culture defined by hurry sickness. Hurry sickness. This phrase was coined by a cardiologist, actually his name was Meyer Friedman. And Friedman, what he did was he looked at A-type personalities, you know, those driven types that just want to achieve more and more. And in his research, he wanted to see what were the physiological impacts or outcomes of this type of personality. And in looking at these types of people, he actually coined this term hurry sickness. Here's some other definitions that we can use as we think about patience, remaining calm while waiting for something, and our culture of hurry sickness. Here's a definition. A behavior pattern characterized by continual rushing and anxiousness. Anxiousness, rushing more and more. A malaise in which a person feels chronically short of time and so tends to perform every task faster and to get flustered when encountering any type of delay. This is the person who is drinking their coffee, putting on their makeup, and honking at somebody who is stopped at a red light. That's the image, right? Here's Friedman's definition himself about hurry sickness. A continuous struggle, an unremitting attempt to accomplish or achieve more and more things or participate in more and more events, in less and less time. This is our world. Whether you're an A-type personality or not, we all feel this so deeply in our culture. So we have here the virtue of patience in a culture of hurry. And we all have this hurry sickness. There's another book called The Time Cure, and these psychologists actually write about some of the ways that this hurry sickness manifests or presents itself in our lives. The first way that they say this actually manifests is in the checkout line at the grocery store, right? When you have 15 items or less, right? And you go to the express checkout line. We can't wait for the other checkout lines because we have 15 items or less, right? So we're in the 15 items or less checkout line, and then you're thinking, okay, which one is gonna get me fastest through this line? They say that's a sign of a hurry sick culture. Second way is the multitasking to the degree or to the point where you've actually forgotten what you're supposed to do. And so this is kind of the person where you open their computer and there's about 40 different browser windows on the internet and there's different things going on in all of them. And then you realize, I don't know why they're all open in the first place. That is a sign of a hurry sick culture. The third one is when you're in traffic, right? Now here in Calum's, you don't experience this as much, but Lower Mainland friends, you know what this is like. When you're in traffic and you're kind of seeing which line, you're darting in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. One of the evidences of my hurry sickness was in 2011, I did a program in Seattle and I was living in Coquitlam at the time. So once a month, for about 3 or 4 days, I'd drive down to Seattle for a program for education, then I'd have to drive back. Well, driving back, I was excited to get home to my wife and to my kid. And so I would go at the highest time of travel, getting into Canada at the border, right? So I would go up and I would say, okay, which line is gonna be the one that's gonna get me through the border the fastest? Sometimes I had to wait for like 3 hours. And listen to me, it seemed like every single time I chose the wrong line. So if you ever go through the border with me, don't ever ask me which line, because I always seem to choose the wrong one, where the person just kept passing me as they were getting through the border. These are evidences of a hurry sick culture in the face of the virtue of patience. So my guess is that in your life, in some way, whether you are a retiree or whether you're like in grade 5, that you feel this anxiety, this pressure, that we are all overburdened, overworked, panicked, hurried, anxious, and ultimately impatient. So we have to ask, what is going on? This good and beautiful life and the virtue of patience, where do you get it? What is its origin or its source? What I want to do is I want to help us think about this both culturally and scripturally. There's a book called The Way of the Modern World by Craig Gay. Great book, a little bit academic. If you're interested in trying to analyze our secular world, I couldn't recommend the book enough. The Way of the Modern World by Craig Gay. What he says is that our world is characterized by control, secularity, and anxiety. Let me lead you through it. The first is that our world is defined by control. Control through what? Control through technology. Control through technology. That we all have an iPhone or a smartphone of some way or some device that helps us organize our lives. And so hear me, I'm not downing these things or I'm not being disparaging. They've been great. But the myth is that you actually can control your life through technology. And what does technology do? The point of technology is not to slow you down, but to speed you up. It's to make you more productive, more efficient, right? So I have on my watch an Apple Watch that can track everything about my day, how many steps I take, how many calories I burn, and how many hours I can stand or have stood that day. Now, it's a great helpful tool, but what is its point? The point is to make me more aware and more efficient, and underlying all that is control. I can control my health through activity. And that's good, of course, you can. But the idea that we can control everything is actually a myth. And so control through technology leads to what? Secularity. That if I'm the one in control, there's no need for God. If there is a God, he is not involved, he is unaware, and really has nothing to do with my everyday life. Control through technology leads to a secularity. There is no God. If there is one, he is a deistic God. He is up in the clouds or on his rocking chair. He is not involved, or he does not care. And this idea of secularity is that I am the primary person in the universe. If there is no God, it is all up to me, which Gay says leads to anxiety. It's all up to me. That I have control of all areas of my life, including my health, my relationships, my vocation, my education, my sexuality. It's all up to me. God is distant or he doesn't care. And so it's all up to me. And what does that lead to? It leads to impatience, because if I am the one who is ultimately responsible for every outcome, every efficiency, every productivity in my life, I want that life now. The good and beautiful life is all up to me. I am in control because I can create it. You see how that works? Our world is characterized by control, secularity, which leads to this anxiety because it's all up to me, right? If we're waiting upon God for the good and beautiful life, then that leads to patience. But the human condition and the human experience is one of what? Not delayed gratification, but instant gratification. If I can create the good and beautiful life, then I want it that now, and I cannot wait for it. This is an impatient culture. As we think through our culture, this is what the narrative, the script that we read, it's all up to you, and you create your best life, the good and beautiful life now. Is this the only narrative that we can get? No. I want to think through this, help you think through this scripturally. One of the mantras or the character of God that is repeated all the way throughout the Old Testament and even the New is found, first of all, in Exodus chapter 34. This is one of the earliest kind of creedal statements in the Old Testament about the character and nature of God. Who is God? We've defined our culture, but who is God? In Exodus 34, the author says this, and he passed in front of Moses proclaiming, the Lord, or Adonai, Adonai, the compassionate. This is the first characteristic of God. Compassion means that God has favor and tenderness towards people. He's not out to get people. He has compassion. He is gracious. What is God like? He is actually gracious. He has favor to those who maybe don't deserve it. Listen to the next attribute or character of God. He is slow to anger. He is patient in the midst of all of the rebellion of humanity. He is slow to anger. He's abounding in love and faithfulness. The Hebrew word here is a Hebrew word chesed, which basically means like a covenant loyalty, a never giving up, always overwhelming type of loyal love despite and in the face of all things. Maintaining love to thousands. It goes on from here, but this was in Jewish thought and Jewish scholarship, this is what's called the Midot. The Midot. The Midot literally in Hebrew is the 13. And so it goes on. I'm not going to show you all 13 characteristics of God, but the Midot is actually repeated all the way through the Old Testament as who is God like, or who is God? This is who he is and what he is like. One of those places is in Psalm 108. You can read that maybe if you want. God is defined by one who is slow to anger. You know, one of the interesting things that commentators will note about Exodus 34 is that Exodus 34 comes right after one of the most fractious, rebellious moments of the entire Old Testament. God has pulled his people from Pharaoh, brought him to himself, covenanted with him, promised his very self to them. And while this is all happening, the people of God burn and melt gold into a calf and worship it instead of the real God. This is such an act of treason to this holy God. And so what is God's response to human rebellion? Compassion, grace, slow to anger. In our world of hurry, we actually follow a God that is slow to anger, who is patient with us, remains calm as he waits for our obedience and our love and our worship. The idea that God is slow to anger means that God is more patient than you, patient with you than you are with yourself. So here's the encouragement, this maybe for you, is maybe you've had a terrible week. Maybe you relapsed this week, or you said words that you wish you would not have, or you didn't say words that you wish you would have. And so you come this weekend and you're down on yourself, and the tape that you're playing to yourself is, what's wrong with you? You know, sometimes we even say, man, you idiot, why are you doing this, right? But the fact that God is slow to anger means that he is more patient and kind with you than you are to yourself. And that idea is mind-blowing, because as we think about slow to anger, the times that we are angry, we often regret. That our impatience with ourselves, with our world, with the people in our world leads to regret. I wish I would not have done that. You never see this in who God is. That our impatience leads to anger, and God is not like that. He is slow and patient with you as you struggle and fumble your way through your life. My friends, he loves you more than you love yourself. This is the Midot. This is the creedal affirmation of who God is. He is patient with you and patient with us. The nature and character of God is fully seen in the person of Jesus. I want to show you around some of these gospel moments where Jesus shows this idea that he is gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. The question I have for you is, how do you feel when you get interrupted? How do you feel when you get interrupted? Me, I am not good when I get interrupted. I mean, I'm a task-oriented person. I like checking things off, moving the ball forward, taking the next hill, whatever you want. So when I get interrupted, I feel the dislocation of that in what I actually want to get done. Here's four moments where Jesus gets interrupted and he responds like the God described in Exodus 34. Luke chapter 5, 17 to 19. Jesus teaching to a full house. There's packed. People are wanting to see Jesus. He's teaching, opening the scriptures about the kingdom of God. And all of a sudden, a group of friends with one of their friends who is lame and hurt and paralyzed, open the roof and he drops down on Jesus while he's teaching. I mean, imagine if you were at church or at the symphony or at a presentation and all of a sudden it gets interrupted by people who say, I want your attention now, and the whole thing is derailed. Imagine as a presenter what that would be like. You're trying to make sense of everything. Read it for yourself. Jesus stops everything, heals this man, and encourages his friends. In the middle of interruption, Jesus shows patience, love, favor, and grace. Matthew chapter 8, verse 23 to 27. How do you feel, young parents, when you get interrupted with your sleep? I don't do well with that. What happens in Matthew 8? Jesus is sleeping in the boat in the middle of a storm. It's the height of his ministry. He's fully human and he needs a nap. His disciples freaked out of the storm. Come, hey, wake Jesus up. Jesus, we're in trouble. We're about to sink. Jesus comes, rebukes the wind and the waves, and rebukes the disciples, not for waking him up, but for not trusting in who he is. Jesus, in the middle of interruption, takes this moment with his disciples to teach them again about who is with them. Then, in Matthew 14, 13 and 14, Jesus is grieving the loss of his friend, John the Baptist. In Matthew chapter 14, here's how it ends in verse 12. In verse 11, it says, his head was brought in on a platter and given to the girl. John the Baptist beheaded, okay? Verse 12, John's disciples came and took his body and buried it, then went and told Jesus. Jesus, your friend John has just got his head lopped off. He has been murdered. Jesus would grieve this moment. His friend has just been murdered. In the middle of his grief, it says this in verse 13, when Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. He went to go be with the Father. The grief and loss of John's death. Listen to this. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the town. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. In the midst of Jesus' grief, imagine going to a widow's house, knocking on the door and inviting yourself in so that they would serve you. It would never happen, at least in our culture. And yet here in the midst of Jesus' grief, large crowds with enormous needs, heals their sick and later in the chapter, feeds them. Why? Because he is slow to anger. He's abounding in love and favor towards people. Mark chapter 5, verse 21 to 24, Jesus is again interrupted. That Jesus's interruptions are actually interrupted itself. Jesus gets out of the boat and all of a sudden, boom, large crowd interrupted. So he starts to teach. In the middle of that interruption, another interruption comes. Jairus comes and pleads with Jesus to go heal his daughter. Jesus' interruptions also get interrupted, and Jesus goes and heals Jairus' daughter. Who and what is God like? He is slow to anger. He is patient. He is kind. He's abounding in love. You see that most clearly in Jesus. And it's in Galatians 5, again, where we see this idea that the fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and patience. In the middle of our hurry culture, overburdened, panicked, and anxious, we follow one who is slow to anger and abounding in love for you and me, who is patient with us in the midst of our struggles. Remaining calm while waiting for something is a fruit of the Spirit. It's an evidence of the life of God in your life. He shares his patience with you, and you share it with others. The image of patience that I got this week was that scene in Braveheart. If you know Braveheart, it's Mel Gibson's film, the Scottish warrior. And at the end of the movie, there's the opposing army that's coming towards Mel Gibson's character and the rest of his army. And as they're coming on horses, Mel Gibson's character says, "Hold, hold, hold, remaining calm while waiting for something." It's the idea, this classic military idea of holding until the right time. This is the fruit of Jesus wanting to give it to you in this life. So here's the big idea this weekend, that the fruit of the Spirit brings patience to our world of anxious impatience. And this inner transformation will improve every aspect of your life. That this idea of patience will improve every single aspect of your life. My friends, you Wordle players out there, Wordle, you know that daily word game on New York Times? I play with my wife every day. I'm telling you, if you actually have more patience, your Wordle game is gonna get better. That's the impact of the fruit. If you actually have this inner transformation by the Spirit of Jesus living in your life, your parenting will get better, your spiritual life will get better. Imagine this. How would you have dealt with COVID differently if you had more patience? If you were actually able to remain calm while you waited for it to be done? We all know that we need this, and we all know that we don't have it. So let me speak to your heart a little bit. Let me speak to your heart as we think about the need for patience. We all know that we need it, and yet we don't have it. Your life demands that you have the fruit of patience. So how are you gonna get this good and beautiful life? You need this virtue with your vocation. I think now of some of you students who are graduated or graduating from TRU, and you are in a season of waiting. Waiting to hear back from that job, waiting to hear whether you got into your master's program, waiting for the perfect summer job, waiting to hear, waiting. You are in a season of waiting. How do you remain calm and obedient in that time? As I think about kind of my vocational career, I've shared this with you before, but I think it's really appropriate. I wanted to be a lead pastor for a long time. And so what that meant was I got my resume all ready and I applied to a few different places. The first place that I applied, I didn't get, was prayerful and it was beautiful and it was really a big lesson for me. But I got into this season of a lot of restlessness vocationally. I just wanted the next thing. So I was up in the middle of the night with my son, Micah. I had my resume. I was on this search group, this Christian kind of headhunting group for lead pastor roles. And I applied to a church in the United States. It was an enormous church in the United States. And I just thought, there's no way I'm going to get it. So a week later, didn't pray about it, didn't talk to Chris about it. A week later, I'm on a date night with Chris and I say, "Oh, by the way, I applied to this place to be the lead pastor. There's no way I'm gonna get it, but just so you know." She's like, what? You applied to move our family to the United States? You never told me?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's not gonna happen." Long story short, I was this close to getting this position, right? It was not, and it would have been a disaster. It would have been a complete disaster. What it proved to me was that I'm unwilling to wait in the tension vocationally. I was unwilling to just wait upon the Lord for the right thing. And by God's grace and wisdom, I didn't get it and I ended up here. You need patience vocationally. You need patience relationally. For those of you, as we talked about marriage for 3 months, you're in a tough season of your marriage. And you want to be further ahead, you want to be closer, you want more connection, and yet you're not feeling it. this tension and this restlessness leads you to look at every other option. Maybe I should get out, but I think what you need is patience. Wait. There's a better season ahead. For those of you who are parenting, you need patience like crazy. For those of you who are grandparents, and you're looking at your grandkids, you're like, this is a mess. They're rebellious. They don't know the Lord. What do you need? You need patience. You need to remain calm, prayerful, and obedient as you wait. For those of you who have young kids, you need patience as you remain calm as it seems to take your child 25 minutes to put on their shoes or get out the house. You need patience. Spiritually, we need patience. As we think about apprenticeship to Jesus, we need this virtue of patience with ourselves. You know, I've been around our tradition, evangelicalism, for a long time, and we love, as evangelicals, kind of the fast transformation story. I was this, and then all of a sudden this happened, and then my life was changed forever. And can that happen? Should that happen? Do we celebrate when it happens? Yes, absolutely. But here's what I've seen also happen, is that there's immediate transformation. We get the camera out, we show the video, and then that person deeply struggles for a long time. After this big wild story happens, that person stumbles and fumbles and backslides and then doesn't know what to do with themselves. And what is that? We love the instantaneous transformation story. It's possible, but sometimes we in our tradition highlight that too much. Because what do we believe? At the heart of that, we believe that spiritual formation and transformation is kind of like the vending machine. I'll have patience, I'll have, you know, a little joy, and you put the money in, and then it comes out, and then it's done. I got it forever. But my friends, we all know that it's not like that. That apprenticeship to Jesus demands patience. It's not a slot machine or a vending machine. It's a process of us becoming like Jesus. That the heart of the Christian faith is that this idea that we wait upon Jesus for our fulfillment. That the heart of Christianity says that we must patiently seek and give up earthly happiness as we wait for something better. That we must suspend some of our desires now in this life for something that's going to happen later on. For that desire to be fully fulfilled later on. As we talked about singleness, that's what we talked about. That's how the New Testament talks, that there's a longing for something. We all have unmet desires. And Christianity says you must wait upon the Lord for that desire to be fulfilled now, but ultimately to be fulfilled later. And so what this means is Christians, we live in tension. We live in this tension of desiring things that we must wait on. Remaining calm and obedient in the midst of waiting. So regardless of who you are and how you arrive, what area of your life demands this virtue of patience? Will you be patient as you wait? There's a Japanese theologian. His name is Kosuke Koyama. He wrote a book called The 3-Mile-an-Hour God. In the midst of our restlessness, in the midst of our striving, in the midst of our wanting to resolve everything right now, in the midst of all these unmet desires, we want to get them all sorted out. And in the midst of that, we are reminded again of the patience of God. Here's what Kosuke Koyama says in his book, The 3-Mile-an-Hour God. He says, God walks slowly because he is love. If he is not love, he would have gone much faster. Love has its speed. It is an inner speed. It is a spiritual speed. It is a different kind of speed from the technological speed to which we are accustomed. It is slow, my friends. It is a patient speed. It is Lord over all other speeds, since it is the speed of love. At the heart of being patient is an act of love. Because patience demands love. Patience demands love because it's not about me. It's actually about the other person. The love of God is a slow type of love that is patient with you in the middle of your parenting struggles, marriage struggles, vocational struggles, or even your spiritual struggles. God is slow and patient with you. The question is, can you slow down? So we've thought about this with our head, culturally, with gaze work. We've thought about this scripturally. What is God like in Jesus? We've thought about this with our heart, man. We know we all need this, and yet we don't have it. Is there something that we can do with our hands? Is there something that we can actually do to put this into our muscle memory of as far as slowing down and being patient? And my friends, yes, there is. Yes, there is. I want to give you two practices now that can hopefully ingrain this or challenge this or grow this a virtue of patience in your life. The first is the idea of Sabbath. My friends, Sabbath teaches you patience. Sabbath means to stop. Stop. Stop running. Stop fretting. Stop hurrying. Stop consuming. And start instead focusing in on your soul. See, Sabbath was ingrained in the heart of the rhythm of life. You work 6 days and one you rest. This is the rhythm of creation and the gift given to us as Jesus followers. Sabbath teaches you to walk at the speed of love. To deny the fact that the best life is actually one that you create. And that life has to be lived now. Sabbath teaches you that the emails and the phone calls can wait. It teaches you that life is best lived in relationship with God, not on the margins, but at the core of your life. Sabbath is this unhurried posture towards all of life. And my friends, it is the antidote to our hurry sick souls. Sabbath is the weekly practice of patience that becomes a part of our muscle memory. I've heard somebody say that if you don't practice Sabbath willingly, you will have to practice Sabbath because it is imposed on you because you've burnt out. Because you were overburdened, you were overworked, you were anxious, and you were in a hurry for way too long. You were designed to walk at the speed of love and to slow down. 6 days, giver, but one day, you must slow down. So I want to give you this graph. Restfulness through Sabbath or restlessness through our hurry culture. Which one more describes you? Do you have margin or are you always busy? Sabbath teaches us to slow down. Our culture tells us to hurry up. Restfulness gives us peace and quiet. There's a relentlessness of our culture through noise. Deep relationships through rest. Isolation through relentlessness. Always doing more. More meetings, more evenings out. Time alone on Sabbath to think and process. And the relentlessness of the crowds. The delight of Sabbath, of stopping and enjoying relationship with God and with others. Or the distraction of your device and notifications. The enjoyment of just time, unhurried time. Or the envy, I want more, in the comparison game. The clarity of Sabbath or the confusion of our culture. The gratitude, oh, look at all that God's given me, or the greed, I must do more and achieve more. Contentment or discontentment, trust or worry, love or anger and angst, joy or sadness, peace or anxiety, working from love that Sabbath teaches or working for love. Work as contribution or work as accumulation and accomplishment. How do you become more patient, my friends? You practice Sabbath. Slowing down, enjoying. The second way is through the Eucharist or communion, which is what we're going to do as a practice this weekend. This is a centering core practice for Christians, including our church. And I just want to intro this with John 13:1. It was just before the Passover festival, John writes. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. This is the verse that stuck out to me this week. Having loved his own who were in the world, listen, he loved them to the end. John 13 is the beginning of the passion narrative of Jesus that he is about to go to his death. That Jesus, with his disciples, who were frustrating, who were slow, who didn't get it, full of mistakes and pride and prejudice and all of the effects of sin, doubts, misgivings, fights, inner turmoil, Jesus loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. To the end. So you and I love up to a limit. It's often when we are betrayed where we stop loving. When that person annoys us or slows us down. When they don't do what we want or say what we want or act the way we want. Then we stop loving. The heart of Christ for you is that he loves you as he loved his disciples all the way to the end. To the end of what? To the end of his own death. See, the clearest picture of God's patience is with your sin and my sin. And Jesus here in John 13:1 looks ahead at the cross of the torture of the pain, and he loves us all the way through to the end. Jesus looks ahead to the abandonment of the Father and still loves you to the end. That Jesus bore, that he took on physical death, torture, and pain for you and I, for our misgivings, for our sin, for our rebellion. And because of Jesus' love, unending, patient love for you, we can trust in him for all that he has done and all that he promises for us. That we bring him from the margins of our life to the center. And it is up to him as we wait on him. As the resurrection proves that all of Jesus' promises are true, that he is alive and he deeply cares. And so this is the weekend where we gather around the bread and the cup and we remember again of Jesus' patient love for you demonstrated on the cross. So this weekend, would you participate in these elements in your home or wherever you find yourself with gratitude of his redeeming love for you? Jesus, I'm grateful that you have been patient with me. In my restlessness, in my discontentment, Lord, I pray that you would search us. That you would find the ways in which we are trying to control too much. Thank you for forgiving me and us of the outbursts of anger that have come from our impatience, whether that's with our kids or with our career, whether it's with our spouse or another important relationship, Lord. And would you give us the life, the very life of Jesus in the midst of relational dynamics that often are annoying or are interrupting our schedule or our desire, may you share your life with us, that we would be people who wait upon the Lord. And in doing so, would trust you more. Meet us in this moment, we pray. Amen. Bless you now as you take the elements. Bye-bye.